Thanks, Greg, and thanks for coming out. I'm going to tell you about this one puzzle of how one system can possibly remember multiple things without getting them confused. And I'm going to try and get at this puzzle by giving you examples from different material examples. But I wanted to start with a metaphor or with an example from the field where maybe this question was first thought about, and that's in neuroscience. Because I think it sort of gets at the question in a simple way. So I think we all know that, you know, when you want to store a memory in the brain, you make synaptic connections. So maybe if you want to, and I'm just talking about this in a very superficial way. So if you want to store an image of that spider, you can imagine your brain needs to make some synaptic connections to store that. So let's say those are the blue connections between a set of neurons. And then imagine you also wanted to store a picture of these beer bottles. That requires some red connections, or pink, or whatever there. And to store an image of that dog, maybe you need those green connections that you see there. And the puzzle is, well, what if you remember all three things? What if you have learned all three things? Now you have all the three sets of connections between the same set of neurons. Is this brain good for anything? Is this neural network good for anything? And you should think not naively, because, well, you can see the colors of these connections. But once those synaptic connections are made, you know, they all exist. And so when you're trying to think about the dog, the connections from the spider or the beer bottles are just as valid and affect the dynamics just as much, right? And in fact, you can, in simple models, you can formalize this notion and show that generically, if you do combine the synaptic weights needed for different memories, that the resulting neural network of the brain, in some sense, is pretty useless. In some abstract sense, it's represented by an energy landscape where there are all kinds of other false memories that show up, which look like combinations of these memories. And famously, John Hopfield showed a long time ago that if you take, at least in some very simple models, that you don't always have this kind of bad situation. That if you store few enough memories, if you don't store too many memories, this doesn't happen. If you get the other things right, if you get the range of interactions right, if you do everything else right, actually, you can store multiple memories despite having all the connections present at the same time. In some intuitive sense, what happens is when you start thinking about the bottle, the moment you start thinking about it, you're in the neighborhood of that, the brain is in that neighborhood, the connections corresponding to the other two memories sort of disturb you, but it's like noise, and they mostly cancel each other out and don't have a big impact on your dynamics. And so, anyway, over the last 30, 40 years, theoretically, people thought about when memories can be stored in this way, right, in one thing, and when it cannot. And Remy Monasson talked about some amazing experiments in recent years about how we store multiple spatial memories in the same set of neurons and don't seem to get them confused, right? And there's some interesting physics there. But this is sort of the puzzle I want you to keep in mind, and I hope it sounds it should sound puzzling to you, that you could have the plastic elements for different memories at the same time in this one system and yet be able to think about any one of them without confusion, right? So that's sort of the puzzle I want you to keep in mind. But I'm actually going to talk about that kind of question in materials. And I'm going to start with some work on self-assembly that Zorana and I did, and some extensions to mechanical systems by a graduate student, Menahem Stern. So I'm going to give a couple of different examples, but the first one I'm going to tell you about is in the context of self-assembly. But self-assembly in a context that may be somewhat unfamiliar to physicists, it's called DNA brick assembly. And it's unfamiliar because when these people build structures, they use, in some sense, an extremely large number of different kinds of components. So when physicists think self-assembly, they think of, you know, maybe many, 500 identical particles coming together to assemble something. So these people, they can manufacture arbitrary structures on the nanoscale. So this P is about 80 nanometers in linear dimension. And it's made of, let's say, 200 different particles. And each of those particles is just a strand of DNA that folds up into a brick-like object. But the crucial point is that each brick here has a unique name. It's not the same particle repeated 200 times. Each one has a unique name. In this context, the name is literally the sequence on it. right? And this actually makes things very easy because essentially they can engineer highly specific interactions. Each brick has a name, meaning it has a distinct sequence on each of the four sides, and you can choose that to be anything you want because you can just order this oligonucleotides from a company that synthesizes these strands. Right? And so if you have a species called species 1 and a species 2, you get to order them in a way that, meaning by order I mean you get to buy them such that sequence, brick 1 has a sequence, brick 2 has its exact complementary sequence in the north end. That means brick 1 will only bind to brick 2 in that particular orientation and to nobody else. So it's essentially, you get this enormous specificity. You get to have 200 different species of particles, and you get to say who talks to whom and who doesn't talk to whom in a completely, almost deterministic manner. If you wanted to do the same, I mean, it would be impossible to do the same thing with chemistry. You couldn't easily create 200 species of particles with an arbitrary interaction graph, right? But here it's just computer science, because it's just based on what's in correct pairing. Yeah? You folks with me on this so far? Right. So then if you buy that, then it's not such a big mystery how this could work, because what they do is they divide this P up into a whole bunch of particles and then give them all names and then make sure that every particle will accept exactly one partner at each binding site, right? It's like a bunch of, it's like people sitting in this room, but imagine each of you was highly specific in every direction to the neighbors you're currently sitting with. Then every time you filter in, you're going to sit down in the same exact way. Right, it's no mystery. I mean, I'm oversimplifying a bit. There are some kinetic challenges in these experiments, but at least the specificity goes a long way towards getting it done. All right, so the question I'm going to get at is, so I want you to think of this as essentially like having programmed the memory of this one structure into these interactions. So I think Zarana must have talked about designing self-assembly in this way, and this is, we are going to call this one memory, right, where you put highly specific interactions. And so just sort of inspired by the Nero-like idea that we ask, can you program one set of particles with the ability or the memory of multiple structures? And the way we are going to do that is by simply making each particle promiscuous in each direction. So 3 used to bind only to 6 because that was the relationship in this structure, but maybe 3 is sitting next to 12 in this structure. So now we actually order the sequence, we buy the sequence in a way where this sequence is no longer highly specific. It can bind to this one or to this one. And if it's a third structure, to that one as well, right? So, and similarly on the left-hand side. And that's called promiscuity. It's usually thought of as a bad thing, right? I mean, you usually work hard to make things highly specific so that you get exactly what you want. But now we want to have, now we want multiple things, so we try to make things promiscuous. And the question is this okay? And this should remind you of the first slide about the brain with multiple things, because now you've got, now each particle can pick up one of 3 partners, so it's not clear that they will collectively do one deterministic thing. At least locally, there's a lot more choice in what they do, right? So I'm going to show you what actually happens. So before doing that, instead of making 3 arbitrary structures like that, 3 shape structures, the 3 target structures I'm going to have are all going to be squares, which sounds disappointing, but actually the 3 squares in question are going to be completely random permutations of those 25 particles. Right? So in terms of broad shape, they all look the same, but really they're completely different structures. We're just doing this to keep bookkeeping to a minimum. It doesn't really change anything. But so when I say a structure, I mean a completely random permutation of those particles. And so then I need to explain why I've the color then is not a statement about who's making up the structure, but about the local arrangement of particles. It's about the bonds. So when it's colored blue, the blue color here indicates this particular arrangement, the green, the same particles arranged in a different way, and similarly for the red, right? All right, so to set some notation, I'm going to call the number of such target structures M, the number of memories I'm trying to put in. And N, capital N, is going to be the size of the system, the number of species I've put into this. Right? And just, and remember, the way I try to put in multiple species is simply by making things promiscuous. I'm putting in all the interactions needed for all the memories in at the same time. There isn't any little switch there to switch the interactions from one of those to the other. They're all there at the same time. The question is what happens. All right, so here's I'm going to show you 2 simulations. The first one is a soup of particles that was programmed with five different self-assembling behaviors, five different target memories, right? So there, each particle is promiscuous, accepts five partners from each side. The next simulation is the same, but with 25 particles. And the initial condition is going to be a little fragment of one of the memories, right? So there are five memories, and initially I just throw in a self-assembled piece of like one of a seed that's large enough in some sense. In the simulation, you see that it starts self-assembling, and it's mostly red. So the red means it's the arrangement corresponding to the first memory. So the analogy with this room, the simulation is like a few people were sitting down already, and then people start filtering in, and then we retrieve the exact permutation or arrangement that we have here right now. Right? Because those were the only friendships you could have. And here that happened despite having these promiscuous interactions. Particles did have other choices, but somehow globally they still retrieved that exact one memory.
Why did it stop?
That's a good question. I'll get to that. Well, just thanks for noting that it did stop, and it's not obvious it should have stopped. Because now here, when you add 25 memories, two things go wrong. One, the arrangement you get is nothing like the memory you try to retrieve. And second, it keeps growing off to infinity. Right? There's an infinite number of particles. They just assemble this giant chimeric mess. Right? Yeah.
So, again, the only thing, so you've seeded these with the memory that you wanted to trigger.
Exactly.
And in one case, your pen was tiling drives you into the memory that you want. And in the other case, somehow, are there gaps in there?
There are gaps in there. And then there are bonds, but it's like every other bond is from one of the other memories that are, it's borrowed from different memories. There are also solid regions. I mean, there are some white gaps, but there are also solid regions. So somehow it's making itself happy by borrowing bonds from different arrangements.
And what's the penalty that you make for not having a bond?
Right, good question. So secretly there is a penalty. If you make a bond, you get an energy bonus. If you don't make a bond, it's like zero energy, but secretly that's a penalty because like there's a concentration, so there's like a chemical potential. So there's like a penalty for not making a bond because there's a chemical potential. In fact, I'm going to get to that, and that's going to be a critical thing in another slide for now. So something went wrong. Between five memories, things worked. 25, something went terribly wrong. Right? So then we fleshed that out by just increasing the number of memories one at a time. Right, and each time doing the same experiment, you know, releasing a self-assembled, like a small seed, and ask what happens. So it works up to here, and then it fails at some particular number of memories for this particular set of parameters, and then a temperature axis as well, just because. Right? So there is a good regime. There's a regime in which you can have multiple memories and not confuse them, and then a bad regime. And the question is why? Why did it work, and why does it stop working? And the answer to this has to do with Itai's question. The way we like to phrase it is that there was promiscuity, like as you put in more memories into the system, you're relaxing constraints, you're making it more promiscuous. But there is a restoring force, like there's a certain kind of frustration in the system which is helping you for a while. But then once you've put too many memories in, the promiscuity sort of overwhelms the frustration and then things go very wrong. The frustration I'm talking about is best seen if you, let's say you focus on one particular memory, memory 3, and let's say it's finished growing, let's say that's the boundary of memory 3, right? And there are two species at the boundary, let's say 17 and 6. Unfortunately, because there are multiple memories, 17 and 6 still have sticky sides from this way, right? Because they are typically interior particles in the other memories. This has to do with Greg's question, why did it stop growing? If I'd only programmed one structure, this wouldn't be sticky, but with multiple memories, it is a sticky side. So 6 might pick up, say, 28 because of that, 17 might pick up 12 because of that. In fact, 6 could pick up, 6 has just about like M friends from that side, where M is the number of memories I programmed in. Right? The more memories I program in, the more friends 6 has from that side, and 17 does. But what saves us, and so that's bad news because once 3 grows out, it could continue growing by picking up these friends. And these are bonds meant from other memories, right? Meant for other memories. The good news is if 6 picks up 28 and 7 picks up 12, those two folks may not like each other in the vertical direction. right? Because 12 and 28 may not occur together anywhere. Nobody programmed them to be specific. And that is a frustrated loop, because in some sense, that missing bond has an energy cost because of this chemical potential cost in some sense, right? So it's effectively repulsive, and that sort of destabilizes it. And so that works for a while, until at some point you add so many memories that by accident 12 and 28 are friends after all, from some other memory that you put in, right? And you can ask, when would that happen? Because there are just too many friendships in this soup at some point. And you can, it's a simple idea, but you can actually, it gives you the right scaling behavior. So you say 12 has about M friends from the south, 6 has M friends from the east, and you have to ask, well, what are the odds there's some friend in common to them, right? And you could just think it through quickly. The odds that they have a common friend starts growing, becomes order 1 when M is like square root of N. And the square root comes because I took the intersection of two sets of size M each. Instead, if you did this on a different lattice or in three dimensions or something else, you'd have the intersection of many sets related to the coordination number. And you can show that this capacity would instead scale like this with the coordination number. And just for connoisseurs in the audience, well, for everybody, you can see that this power quickly goes to 1 as Z gets larger. Right? For self-assembly, maybe it's not interesting to make Z very large. But actually, secretly, all of this is closely related to the kind of models that Remy Monasson talked about yesterday in neuroscience. And there, Z is usually a large number. And people usually only talk about linear scaling. The capacity scales linearly with the size of the system. And that's, you can think of that as like a high coordination limit of this, right, for large Z.
It sounds somewhat similar to the birthday problem.
Yes.
And you have a classroom.
Right. That's right.
You ask how is a
That's
classroom
right.
of size N?
Right.
What's the odds of
right.
people
two people having the same thing? That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the two important parameters are the size of the classroom and, right, and in this case, N, the number of memories. Right. So to summarize all of that, so this was a phase diagram I showed you. And this we have a predicted scaling, which we could verify with some simulations, with finite size scaling in simulations. And to connect to yesterday's talk to Remy Monasson, so it turns out this particular self-assembly model is closely related to that specific. So in neuroscience, there are many models of such associative memory. Remy talked about one experimentally motivated one yesterday, and he showed you a phase diagram with the same topological structure. So it turns out that one is the one closely related to this. But the point is that this is the region in which you can associate and retrieve memories. All right. I am going to skip past this. So in the simulation so far, I showed you the initial condition was a seed, and then you retrieve things. But in neuroscience, the important aspect of these memories is that you don't need a perfect like thing to jog your memory. So here we were jogging the memory with a perfect seed, or incomplete but perfect seed. But you really don't need that. It can be a pretty error-prone seed, and you can still get it. And so we essentially showed that in some other paper. But the only reason I want to flash this slide is we had to submit a paper for a memorial issue for Leo. So this graduate student took these three images and equalized the histograms so that they're all made, they essentially correspond to this problem. So all of these images have a unique grayscale value at each pixel and are permutations of each other. So then you could do a self-assembly experiment where you seed things with little pieces and see whether you get a Leo or an Einstein or a cat, and you can compare how good it is as a pattern recognizer in this way. But I'm not going to talk about it except to bring up Leo's image again. All right, so the larger take-home message here is that the self-assembling particles manage to show this kind of behavior, multiple memories, no confusion. And the key was this geometric frustration in two dimensions, right? And three dimensions would be better. And what I want to quickly run through now is that you see similar effects in very diverse systems. The only common element, really the common element across this, is that they're all sort of designer systems. You program some system to show exactly one behavior, and then you relax those constraints so that you have two target behaviors, and then relax a little more to have three. And for a while that works, and at some point it breaks down. And so something else will play the role of frustration to save you in the other cases. So I think I will, right, maybe the origami one. Right. So I'm going to just show you very briefly a similar idea in folding sheets. So I had self-assembly, but now it's self-folding. We call it self. The word self here just refers to, you know, what Tachi is doing here. So this person, Tomohiro Tachi, designed the angles between the creases in the sheet so carefully that the folding doesn't really require any supervision. You know, he can just push it from anywhere, and then it folds, right? So it's not just an art. People in the audience, Itai and others, you know, have taken this far, you know, to the microscale as a general synthesis method for making structures. But the general philosophy is you lay out the program very carefully, like a set of deformation modes, and then you can push it anyway and get it. And so the question I'm going to ask is, what if you just combine the soft spots needed for two different folding modes into one structure? Just take the union. Right? It's a softer sheet now, and it's obvious it can still show those two targeted behaviors. What's not obvious is that this can be done in a self-folding manner. Or maybe because what could happen is that this becomes so soft that now it needs to be micromanaged to fold into either mode. Right? You could end up having all kinds of extra new modes. And what I'm going to show you is generically that we're okay, much like associative memory. So here I take these two patterns, one of which is Tachi's and the other is a classic pattern called a box pattern. Right? And you put it on a stiff sheet of paper, and you don't need to micromanage this folding. The moment you start folding a little bit of the pink creases in some sense, the deformation somehow only propagates to the pink creases and folds all the pink creases and leaves the blue ones alone. The moment the blue stuff starts folding, it ignores all the pink stuff and only folds the blue stuff. Right? So why? The question is, I mean, the sheet doesn't know what color the creases are, right? And yet it sort of segregates. It segregates the two patterns.
The constraints know about each other.
Yeah, I think you're saying what I thought was my contribution. But yes, don't destroy the magic trick. Don't destroy. You can't. It's not cool to call out the tricks. So all right. So I'm going to tell you why this works, and it has to do with the constraints in here. So and I'm going to give you a sort of simplified picture. So imagine you have one pattern, and an origami. You know, I didn't make this, but someone left it here. When you have a crease. People talk of creases folding as a mountain or a valley state, meaning it's folding out at you or away from you. It's a mountain or a valley. And the main thing you need to know is if you crimp that crease into a mountain, that sort of information comes to that vertex. And at that vertex, there are some rules which are set by the in-plane angles of that vertex, which decide what the other three creases there are going to do. I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but this is a mountain, and these angles decide that this one's going to be a valley, that's a mountain, that's a mountain. Well, if this crease is a mountain, that entire crease segment needs to be a mountain, so that information comes down to this vertex. And at this vertex, there's another vertex rule that decides what's going to happen to this crease, right? Which goes to this vertex, another vertex rule, go up again. And when it comes back, I've shown here that it came back as a mountain, and so those two things agree. And everybody's happy and the whole thing folds. But it needn't have been this way. The reason it's this way for this pattern is Tomohiro Tachi carefully designed the angles at the four vertices so there is no frustration. If you just drew a random pattern, it wouldn't fold because when it goes around, it would typically come back as just as good odds of coming back as the opposite sign. Right? And that, so this loop is not frustrated, it folds. But the possibility of frustration is what saved you, because if you add two random patterns like this, and you ask, and let's say you again crimp this mountain here, and you ask, well, could this deformation propagate into the blue stuff? Well, if you look at a loop that's both blue and red, and you propagate it through, typically you will get frustration, because nobody designed those angles. It's just thrown together, right? And if this loop, you know, you got unlucky and it wasn't frustrated, some other loop is going to be frustrated. In a large pattern, some large fraction of loops will be frustrated. And so they cannot fold at the same time. This is the idea of these constraints that somehow keep them separate, even though the sheet of paper doesn't know what color the creases are. And this fails after a certain point in a combinatorial sense, but it should remind you of this frustrated loop. All right. I'm not doing it on time. So I was going to step to a different problem, maybe a simpler one, where a different kind of effect related to actually some ideas in computer science that Lenka and others have worked on causes the memories to be separate. So much like in self-assembly, now a memory, so imagine you have like 12 particles, and a memory is going to be a spatial configuration of these particles, right? Just like in self-assembly, it's not on a lattice, but some configuration. But this time, I try to memorize it by just putting springs with some rest length between them, right? So these are, I try to memorize, to learn that memory means I put in springs with those rest lengths. So when you try to move it away, there's a penalty and it comes back. And you can obviously memorize this one by putting springs here. And I think you know my question. Could you memorize both memories with one system, right? If you put both sets of springs in, and I give this to Greg, can Greg figure out what the two stored configurations were, right? And what circumstances can you do this? So let's say these were Hookean springs with some rest length. Would you think this would work? Does it sound easy to do or impossible to do? The answer usually says something about you, but with Hookean springs, what would you think?
Sounds hard.
Sounds hard, all right. With Hookean springs? All right, so let's say each of the springs would have stabilized memories, and these are abstract representations, but let's say they would have stabilized memories at these two locations. And now you put both springs, and we decided to ask this question as a function of the nonlinearity of the springs. So we go from Hookean springs, which are, I'm going to call like x squared springs, to x to the 1.5, x to the 1, x to the 0.5, x to the 0. The exact shapes of the potentials are shown here, right? We just open out the side slowly. What you find is when you use Hookean springs, in some sense, the two minima completely disappear. The two minima used to be here. You put all the springs together, you get some minimum right in the middle of them. Right? It's sort of because it should remind you of the idea like you take two quadratics, well, you just get another quadratic. It's not quite that statement because there's a geometric nonlinearity here, but it's mostly that. All right, so Hookean springs are terrible. So then we start dialing down the power of these springs. So you go to 1.2. You see some semblance, but it's not yet there. The moment you go below 1, the two memories start being stable again, right? And then you go further lower and lower, and the memories are more and more stable, but then you also notice that the attractor basin around them gets very, very small. And so it becomes less and less useful. So in some sense, the take-home result is that if you want to encourage, you know, storing multiple memories without distorting each other, you need nonlinearity, and you need nonlinearity somewhere between, in this very specific sense, somewhere between 1 and 0, and where the parameter I'm talking about is how the energy scales, right? E equals x to the psi with this nonlinearity.
Where are the extra memories coming from?
Good question, right, so anytime, so this is a generic property of all these things. So the moment you store multiple memories, you always create many, many distractors. So when I say things succeeded and failed, what I really mean is how many such distractors did you get? So at capacity, what happens is just the number of these distractors grows enormously, that it eats up all the attractor region, and so there is no space left. But even with two memories, you always get distractors. So what I'm showing you here is just like a one-dimensional visualization of this high-dimensional landscape. You shouldn't take it too seriously, but spiritually, like, those distractors are eating up volume. So that's the result, but I want to present this result in a slightly different way, which is related to some things we've heard about. So imagine we play this game where I give you the distances, pairwise distances between many cities in the United States, and I ask you to reconstruct their two-dimensional layout, right? You can surely do that. I mean, there are MATLAB packages, multi-dimensional scaling, which will move it and figure it out. Here's a twist. A few of those pairwise distances I give you are completely wrong. I don't tell you which ones, but maybe it's something like I tell you Santa Barbara and LA are, you know, 800 miles apart. So you don't know which ones are wrong, but you know some are completely wrong. And so now how would you reconstruct the layout of these cities? If you use the old method, the naive method is like essentially you lay the cities down on a plane and keep moving them around with an energy penalty until they lock up into the right answer. And if that penalty is like an x squared penalty, that's a terrible idea when a few distances are very wrong. because, you know, if a few springs are very wrong, it's going to make all the springs a bit unhappy, right, with usual springs. But instead, if you use a spring of this type, an X to the zero spring, think about what that means. It's a great idea if you use this. But what the spring really means is it's a spring where the penalty is either on or off. The spring is happy, but the moment you stretch it, it's unhappy. But you stretch it more, it's no more unhappy than what it was. Effectively, you're telling the system to minimize the number of unhappy springs, not how unhappy they are, but the number. And that's, in math, it's called a sparsity constraint, because that effectively, it minimizes the number of springs. And so that's a great idea, or it's a better idea, in that that will give you the right answer if you manage to minimize and find the true minimum, right? But you can see the problem with that as a physicist, like there is no gradient in this, right? So it's very hard to actually minimize and find the solution. And so maybe a better idea is to go somewhere in between, like say to x to the 1, where you have some gradient, but maybe it also encourages sparsity, right? So the word, I'm using the word sparsity to mean the idea that you want to minimize the number of unhappy people, and you don't care how unhappy they are, right? That's the spring idea. So this idea might strike many of you as familiar. It's the idea behind this famous thing of compressed sensing that many people in the audience have worked on. In a cleaner setting, they have very clean results. Essentially, they show that if you can choose, when you're doing a minimization, you could choose any norm between L0 and L2. What they show is all the way from L0 to L1, like sparsity is incredibly emphasized. Like you know you'll get a sparse solution. On the other hand, only between an L1 and L2 is the problem convex. Like, is it easy to find the minimum? And so then luckily there is one point of intersection, and so L1 norm is this famous magic norm that lets you do sparse reconstruction without having this sort of convexity problem, right? So that's the same sense in which, so essentially the result here is some analog of that, that as you change the nonlinearity, you have this trade-off between sparsity and the convexity, and something in between is good. I'm going to skip past the polymer stuff, but maybe I should take questions before I have a couple of slides on something completely different, but, I saw that. All right. I was going to show you that this is not a place where we've worked. Yes.
Quick question about the previous slide. When you say x to 0, you really mean a constant logarithm implied there?
So I guess that's sort of a mathematical idealization. In reality, we're really using a spring that's, you know, looks like a realistic potential, so there's always a quadratic part down here. When I say x to the 0, I mean x to the 0 point something.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right. And being down there is not a great idea. So. All right, so I'm going to skip over the polymer stuff. There's interesting biology here. We didn't really work on it. But here's one example. So people have shown that there are polymers. Usually you think of polymers like RNA as being programmed to fold into one thing. For example, this paper showed that one sequence can controllably fold into two different structures. Right? It's the same sequence. It's got a whole bunch of sticky spots. Each one requires multiple folds, but it either chooses to fold entirely into this or entirely into that, and there are some physics reasons for it. And I like this one because these two RNA molecules have function, and the functions are exactly the opposite functions. Like one is a ligase, it chops things, and the other, no, a ligase glues things together, and a cleavase cuts up RNA. Right. So that's pretty cool. All right. So I wanted to, there are no questions. I was going to switch gears and end with like sort of an ad about some preliminary work, sort of in a very complementary direction. And the direction is, it's about time now. So until now, so the memories I talked about, we had a lot of control knobs. I assumed, you know, I could move the positions of all these particles, and I'd put them somewhere, and then they would, you know, recover one memory or something. Right? I had all these control knobs. So in the mechanical network, I got to control everybody's position. So imagine instead you had that mechanical network, but now I only give you one control knob, like the distance between two particles. Right? You only have one control knob. And then I want to ask, well, with that control knob, how many different memories could you access? How many different states can you controllably access with only one control knob? If I now allow you to twiddle that control knob as a function of time, right? So it sounds like a very general question, and we are trying to ask it in a fairly broad context. But literally, if you have some system and you controlled only one parameter as a function of time, how contingent can the final state be on the temporal history? Right? To connect it to a familiar context, so if the temporal protocol was very, very slow compared to all the internal transients of the system, that's an adiabatic limit. And there we know answers. We have adiabatic invariance. Essentially, that says, look, not all the details of your protocol matter. Just compute these few invariants. It's just those aspects of this temporal series that decide where you're going to be, right? So when the signal is very slow, we know the answers to this. When the signal is very fast, we know the answer, because if you just like fluctuate the signal really fast, the system just sees it as a DC signal, and then you have the whatever result for the DC things. So the interesting question is in the intermediate regime. And there, that's where we want to know, can you put any bounds, right? Can you put any bounds in the intermediate regime where the external signal is changing on the same time scale as the transients of the system? So part of the reason I'm talking about this, it's work done by an amazing undergraduate, actually a visiting student from France, Amber, and a local, Kyle, who was an undergraduate here, and I think Greg's discovery, he sent him to Chicago, and really one of the best students I've seen there. This really came out of similar questions in biology where, like, you know, a cell decides to become cell fate type A or type B. 15 years ago, people would have said, well, you choose between them by dumping molecule A or molecule B, like two control knobs. But today, we're finding out in many examples, there's one control knob, one molecule, but the temporal pattern with which you dump it on the cell decides which outcome you go to. Right? So that's sort of inspired, and there are many examples. All right, so here's the setting. So here are the assumptions. And so by system, I literally will mean any dynamical system, right? Maybe that's not everything in the universe, but it's what it is. It's any dynamical system. And the external signal, some SFT, will be a one-dimensional signal. And I'm going to assume it's pulse-like, right? So you get to switch it from a low state to a high state and back. And really what you get to control are the sequence of pulses. I'm going to assume you have long pulses and short pulses, and you get to permute them and create some train. And I want to ask, how contingent can the final state of the system be on different temporal inputs? And the way the system is, and I'm going to be very general about how the system couples, the signal couples to the system. I'm going to say, all I'm going to assume is when the signal is zero, you have one dynamics, F0. When the signal is one, you have another dynamics, F1. Right? Just two different dynamics, and you switch between them back and forth, and we see where we can get. All right, here's a way to make it more intuitive and actually do some math as well. So when you have a dynamical system, you can always draw a phase portrait. Let's pretend it's two-dimensional. If you have a phase portrait, sometimes you can represent it by a height function, sort of like an energy function. It's not really energy, but the phase portrait comes from a landscape. This excludes some dynamical systems like limit cycles, but still includes a pretty broad set. So essentially, we have some landscape, which I'll tell you later, some people call it a more Smale complex. Some aspects of it are called a more Smale complex. All right, so here's the game. F0, so the system is completely general. F0 is some energy landscape, right, except overdamped dynamics. And F1, when the signal is on, in principle, it should be some other completely random landscape. It turns out, from what we can think about it, it's useful if F1 looks like a tilt. F1 needs to be another arbitrary landscape, but it looks like a tilt. And I'm hoping that sort of gets the main idea of the problem through. So really what we have is you have a dynamical system. You have the ball starting in one state. And now I only let you tilt this. It's a two-dimensional system. And I only let you tilt it along the diagonal, right? And yet I want you to get the ball to this corner sometimes or to that corner sometimes, but I only let you tilt along one diagonal. You presumably played with the game where you get to tilt in X and Y and you can get anywhere, right? But that's analogous to having multiple control knobs. If you have a 10-dimensional dynamical system, tilt in 10 dimensions, well, that's easy enough. But the temporal question is you only get one direction. It could be a 10-dimensional dynamical system, only one tilt. How do you get it to different places? Right? And I hope you can start seeing that the only way you could do that is if you tilt back and forth on timescales comparable to the transients within the system. So then you could somehow play with that and get contingency and get places. And what I'm going to show you, what we're working on is a bound on how well you can do that. So let me just show you. So the first thing we do is take the arbitrary landscape and draw what's called a Morse mail representation of it. I'm not going to define it because I think visually it's sort of intuitive. It essentially tells you where all the important points are, you know, the tops of the hill, the bottom, the valleys, the saddles. And these lines are important too. They're sort of like attractor basins. Not exactly, but spiritually close enough. Anyway, so this is, let's say, the F0 dynamics when the signal is off. And now you have a blue signal or a red signal. And let's say you start here, and you're always going to tilt in the diagonal direction, right? And so the solid blue lines are what the system does when you've tilted it, when the pulse is on. The dotted ones are when the pulse is off, when it's actually following this dynamics. And you can see how if you tilt it for this long, let it relax, this long, let it relax, you get up there. But with a slightly different temporal pattern, you would end up quite far away, right? You could imagine doing this. And if you get this, you can easily see how if I gave you two specific patterns and asked you to map them really far apart, you would play with these contour shapes to do that, right? You could play with it on paper and try to do it. But there are surely some limits to that. Like maybe you can do it for two series. Two temporal patterns can always be separated, no matter what they are. But if I give you 10 patterns and ask you to map each of them to distinct points, well, you'll have to work harder. And at some point, you will just fail because there just isn't enough flexibility in dynamical systems, period, to separate more than 50 patterns, something, right? And so that, if there is such a number, that tells you fundamentally just how contingent the output can be on the history. Because if that number is 50, it means, well, it just cannot distinguish patterns to more than that. Many other patterns will be mapped to the same point, right? That's what happens. So I'm not going to go through the proof, but just as a teaser for future results, the basic result we have so far is essentially to this question. If I give you a random set of not just two patterns, if I give you 30 patterns and ask you to create a dynamical system like that, sometimes you'll fail. For small numbers, you'll succeed. For very large numbers, you'll fail. And we ask, what's a typical number at which you fail? And it turns out it's some number like this, where it depends on the dimensionality of the system and the length of the signal in this form, L to the D. And it's sort of a typical result that if I give you a set of L to the D patterns, less than that, you can usually shatter it. Beyond that, you can't shatter it. Anyway, the larger point is just this idea of temporal memory, too, can have like a fundamental limit on how many different outcomes you can have. So I'll stop with that. So.
I'm going to bring the microphone around for questions.
Hi. I was wondering if you had thought about how many fold patterns you could put in origami. I realized that would be a bit harder to define based on, you know, your paper and how close the folds are together and such, but...
Actually, that's exactly the answer. Right, so you got to put in, like... So like in some sense, if you play with like mathematical paper, which is like completely stiff and which can resolve vertices down to any arbitrary distance, it's infinite capacity because everything is different. It's just so. But the moment you put any length scale or like a folding rigidity, then there is a finite capacity. It scales like the, you know, the size of the system to some power. It scales like the size of the system measured in those length scale length units raised to some power. I could show you some.
You're imagining fold patterns that have a single degree of
yes.
actuation.
Yes.
And if you have fold patterns that are more broad in their basin, then things get much more interesting.
By broad, you mean that it's a soft sheet or it's still self-folding?
About bending in the mirror ori.
Oh no, that's.
Or things like that. Then your
it is,
yeah. space opens up, so it's not a single degree of freedom. It's a more structure.
But as long as it's floppy, and so in fact, the way we are doing it is actually for such floppy structures, because truly rigid ones, there aren't that many interesting ones. I mean, there's Mirauri and a few. So actually, we are doing it for such, I think what you mean, like the relaxed ones. So it's an almost zero energy folding mode, but it's not really, and it's a floppy one. But it's still only one. I thought maybe you were going to talk about like 2 degrees of freedom, like those are too floppy to deal with. But if I'm hearing you right, so the faces do bend in the patterns we are talking about. So then the precise statement would be that as you add a few of them, what am I trying to say? Anyway, the faces do bend in what I'm saying.
Other questions? Hold on.
So when you just read this talking stick.
Yeah. So in the beginning of this part of your talk, you said something about some, you know, did you say limit cycles cannot be represented?
Yeah, right.
So explain that a little bit.
A dynamical system is, well, a vector. You lose nothing by saying that's a dynamical system. You can draw a vector field, right? And if the vector field, so this vector field in particular, you can imagine that the flow lines here come from an energy function, like a height function, and you're flowing on it. But if you have a limit cycle in this dynamical system, then there is no height function that could possibly capture all the dynamics, right? Because a limit cycle, by definition, you keep running round and round in circles, and there is no landscape that will force you to keep running in circles, because
with some implicit dynamics, right? This is, so if you think,
right?
I mean, if you think of what a landscape might allow you to reach,
right?
Under dissipative dynamics,
right.
Then what you said is true.
That's exactly.
But right. Intrinsically, the kind of problem you're looking at here, you don't have dissipative.
No, it's always dissipative, but even if it's always dissipative, you could still have a limit cycle, and those would not be captured by simple Morse-Smale complexes. And so, those are also dynamical systems, it's just the dynamics are not described by a height function. So nothing I'd say here applies to those.
But you could have a homoclinic type phenomena, right?
Which would be captured by the height function?
Yeah.
Or,
that's not a limit cycle, but...
No, right. Right, so I think it excludes some things, like limit cycles, but that's... we'll try to extend it later, but also my thought was limit cycles are sort of like things that are familiar to underdamped physicists. It's like an underdamped oscillator. And there I thought maybe we are not needed. Maybe, I don't know, many people understand how oscillators can... I don't know, anyway. Like how oscillators would respond to time series? I don't know.
One more question. Sri, you keep talking without the talking stick in front of you.
No, so they may well be damping even in the dynamics you're looking at, but if you want to sort of think of temporal control, then you are you're sort of looking at something other than downhill dynamics.
Right. And I guess I'm saying, right, so for us the signal, I mean, it's sort of like what Sue used to do. I mean, the signal is either on or off. When the signal is off, it's just a, you know, downhill dynamics, dynamical system. When the signal is on, it's another downhill system. The whole thing is non-trivial because I'm going back and forth between them on a time scale comparable to the transients, right?
Okay, we have a question back here.
So on the same topic, I was wondering whether I can think of it as a generalized ratchet, what you're doing to your system, and whether it's useful to think of it as a generalized ratchet, because you're breaking both temporal and spatial symmetry.
Yeah, I didn't think that that's right, huh? I haven't thought it through, but right, it does. Yeah, that's a good point.
I had a question about the intuition behind that L to the D result. Maybe you gave it and I missed it, but to me, you know, like it would make more sense two to the L, or because the length of the signal, you know, that's how many, roughly speaking,
that's exactly
up and down patterns you could get.
No, thank you. I think this is an important point. So the total number of patterns is 2 to the L. And so, head north, right, northeast is the only direction you're allowed to walk in. But so in one way, this result is a very negative result. It says, that, look, if you have L pattern of length L. There are 2 to the L patterns, but you can only get to L to the D, a very small number. But if you think about it a little more, it's actually a very positive result, because L to the D is almost obviously the upper bound, like in the sense that the time series had like L features, you can only move L steps. So the volume you could possibly reach is only L to the D. Mm-hmm. So what's really surprising here is that you can actually reach every spot, like in a naive sense, by playing with these in some crazy, like by tuning these black curves in some crazy manner. I'm not sure what the prefactor is. It could be a small number, but still it's L to the D.
It's interesting because usually you don't raise a time to the power D.
Right, right.
Okay, another question.
Thinking about this the other way, can you take one network and then play with different signals that you can use to get to every spot in the network?
Yeah, in fact, that was going to be our initial thing. And we were going to ask, right, you take a given one, and you take a time series that takes you there. And one interesting question sort of inspired by sort of machine learning-like approaches is to ask, well, what other patterns are mapped to that same point? Like, what kind of distortions are still taken to that same point? Like, that's often an interesting question because, you know, because pattern recognition is not just about, like, saying, yes, I see that specific cat. It's about, generalizing it to distortions. And, in fact, yeah, I mean, that was one motivation for this, was that to ask, how do dynamical systems generalize a specific time series? Like, what else do they consider? Because, you know, often, like in a practical machine learning sense, you classify time series with various methods, which often can't deal with time dilation invariances. Like you take a time series and like you break it up into discrete time units and then feed it to a hidden Markov model or a recurrent network, which are clocked. So if you take a time series, well, to give you an example, in speech recognition, you have an audio file, and you speak a word, and the network recognizes it, and then now if you next time you speak it, you might slow down in some parts, speed up in some parts, like you have local time dilations. In some sense, the usual approach is like at least start off at a great disadvantage for that, because they start by breaking, you know, by discretizing time. One initial inspiration for this was wondering if these systems are somehow very good at dealing with time dilation, or to what extent. But,
cool, thanks. One quick question about the RNA example you gave. Is that, you may not know the answer, is that believed to have any
functional
function? Because you might think that might be bad for a cell to have those two different readings, but it might be good for a virus, which has to co-opt the function.
Two things. Well, so the speculation I've read is that the kind of associative memory, or that kind of double function thing, is very useful in evolution, because let's say you started off as one of those structures, a ligase. You had a sequence that only made a ligase. What this is saying is you can keep the same structure but still evolve in sequence. You can change your sequence, still be functional, and get to a new sequence where all of a sudden I have a second function. So it lets you pick up a new function without losing your old one in sequence space. Right, so, I mean, in terms of evolution, it has consequences, or people think it has consequences. But,
Okay, we have a break now. Well, let's thank Arvind again. We have a break until 3:30, and then we have Sri's talk, which will be the final talk of the conference.